yes, coming up, the Soul Savage Show here on Studio W The Buzz. Got a special guest. I believe that's, Q Lynn. I'm going to let her announce that. But in the meantime, got a little James Ingram we're going to play for you. How about that? Kick back. Soul Savage is coming up next. I'm gonna be there. Hey, welcome everyone. This is Studio W, The Buzz, your global radio network. And that show you've been waiting for, the Soul Savage Show, with, Q Lynn Green. And Q Lynn has a very special guest on today. Who is that, Q Lynn?
Hey, that's Michael McDonald and James Ingram. That was one of my favorite songs. Rest on the James Ingram. He passed away the day before yesterday. I feel like a prominent force when it comes to like great singers. I was like, we're going to play James Ingram the whole show. So anybody listening in, we playing James Ingram. But did you already introduce us? I came in a little bit late because I had to, technical things going on, trying to set up. But we're going to be all right. But we got special guest Monty Croft on. Monty, it's a new year. You're back on the show. How you been? What's going on with you?
Happy New Year. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I'm good. I'm great. You know, I'm paying bills.
Right, exactly. Me and you on the same wavelength right now.
The three of us.
I paid $2
bills
today.
Definitely tax bill. We try to get that situated.
Oh my God.
New blessings, new situations, new blessings call for making sure the IRS get paid.
Right. You don't want to mess with them.
Right, exactly. But how you been though? Seriously, like with the music, I see you posting a lot on Facebook and you know, you're doing your thing at the Sugar Bar. How's that going on? What's the new revelations the listeners, you can clue them in on what you're doing?
Sure. Well, I just noticed that first time we got together was 2017, you know. So it's our third year together.
Right.
I'm talking about
right.
Me and you.
Exactly. Yeah.
Will, you know.
Right.
And that time flies.
It does.
I feel like
right.
I just met you folks, but that was like, you know, 3 years ago.
Right.
But, to answer your question, you know, things are going pretty good. You know, we're steady at the Sugar Bar in New York, Ashford & Simpson Sugar Bar. They're every Wednesday. I actually met Eric, you know, your other partner.
Oh, yeah. He was telling me about that one show that he finally went there.
Yeah, he came by. He came. So I got to meet somebody face-to-face. But, yeah, we worked there last night. You know, cold snap really put a damper on everything. You know, we didn't expect too many people to bow out, and that's really what it was. But, you know, Valerie came out again, Valerie Simpson. Been showing her face more and more, which is always exciting. You know, the band perks up when she's in the house, and got to, you know, spend a lot of time with her, you know, ask her, I'll pick her brain, you know, whenever I get the chance, ask her about all the Motown history and Marvin Gaye and Berry Gordy and working with, you know, her husband Nick and just that whole thing, you know. She's got a lot of information, as it would imagine, you know. Once you start talking to her, you know, Valerie's real good at keeping people at arm's length. But once you break down that barrier, you know, she's got so much to impart, you know, and not just about the record and music stuff, but, you know, about life, you know, her view on life. I'll share one thing she said to me that was just offhand comment, but I thought it was kind of deep. I had made a statement about how, you know, you really got to live your life. I forget what preface did, you know, I don't really remember what we're talking about, but I said, yeah, you got to live your life to the fullest. You only have one life to live. And she said, well, I don't believe that. She said, I believe you have many lives. So, you know, my response is, what are you talking about, reincarnation? She said, no, I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about this one life you have. There are many segments to it, you know. Like, you have these different lives, you know. Like, people, you know, they get married and maybe they get divorced or they lose their partner and then they start off with someone else. And it's like a whole new life, you know. And if you look back and you really think back on your history, it's almost like you were a different person. You really got me thinking about that,
that's
you know.
Deep.
And again, just an offhand comment, but, you know, she's really smart. She's a genius musically, but she's just a really, like, smart, empathic person. I just dig being around her, you know, and I've been performing her songs for her, and she really loves that, you know. I tried one. I didn't know how she would react to it, you know. Think some people probably don't dig that, especially if you don't do a good job on them. Because I've always heard, you know, if there's a celebrity in the house, don't do their song unless you know you're going to kill it, you know. So I'm not really egotistical like that. I never think I'm going to kill it, you know. But I love the song, so I put it in the band set. We started with Remember Me, the this song she had written for Diana Ross. Diana had a big hit on it back in. So, you know, I added that to the band's repertoire because nobody does that song, you know. And she heard it and she was like, wow, you know, that makes me feel really good. Here you do my songs. And I know you know a lot of my songs. And I was like, right. Yeah, I don't know that many. She said, oh, yes, you do. You know a lot of my songs. So last night I added a couple more and, you know, I didn't know she was going to be there. It was a strange feeling, you know, because there was only a few people in the house, and there she was, like, sitting right there. And this is the first time I've taken the band through this new song. I brought in You're All I Need to Get By.
Mm-hmm.
First time we had done it at all. I'd just written the chart. I had been working on it myself, but the guys in the band had not seen it. So the first time we were running it in front of Valerie Simpson. So all
right.
this stuff is going through my mind. It's like, wow, you know, she produced Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell, and well, they sang this song, and she wrote this song, you know. And I had to kind of block all that stuff out, you know, because I didn't want to mess up. I'm like, let me just concentrate on getting these lyrics right and getting these chord changes right. And she was very pleased after, you know, after we. So, yeah, it just makes me happy. It makes her feel good, and that makes me happy to give people roses while they're here, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like Valerie Simpson is, like, undeniably, like, one of those, like, amazing songwriters. Like, I feel like deserves any kind of accolades. I know she's gotten an award a few years ago. I think it was at Soul Train Awards for the Lady of Soul Award. She received that. I think it was like some kind of songwriter award they gave out. And I remember her giving a speech. And what you were saying with that message she gave, it made me, because I think about stuff like that all the time. I talk about renewing life. Like you basically, like that, I can't verbatim say it. What was the quote again you said? She said in terms of life. Like,
yeah, well, I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember exactly what she said, but the gist of it was that we all have many lives. She believes we have many lives, you know. And at first, again, when someone says that, I automatically think they're talking about coming back as something else or someone else. You know, I thought she was on the reincarnation tip, but she's like, no, I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about this life. We have many lives within.
Yeah, and that's so profound in that, because I'm thinking about, like, even my journey as a musician. Like, I've been playing 12 years veteran-wise, and 21 years, I count the 21 years, because that's when, like, everything in terms of studying music and really, trying to, you know, sharpen, that skill, it all started making sense. And to look at what I did 12 years ago, where I was at to where I'm at now, it's completely, like, shifted. And I feel like I've lived, like, four lives. So when you said that, it made me reflect back to, like, when I first started and the other stuff that I was doing. I wasn't even, like, if you would have told me that I would have been playing professionally, because I wasn't really, it was, like, two things. It was, like, I was so enamored with playing that I wasn't, it wasn't that I didn't care about getting paid for music, but it was just that I was just in love, like, passionate about playing. And so it was like you do stuff like play for like $20 or something like that, or you play at nursing homes. I played at nursing homes. I played like
any brand. Some of that.
Hole in the wall clubs. And I liked it. Like, I loved it. It was just the ability to express and being together as a unit, as a band. I liked that camaraderie of musicians and how we got along and how we vibe to the same music. And then it got to the point to where, like, I don't know if it's for you or if you ever experienced this, but it got to a point, it was like maybe my sixth or seventh year in, it felt like I was doing gigs for like a 9-to-5, and then it was like the fun started sucking out of me, because it was like I was looking at gigs as I got to get paid instead of like the process of when I started, like just doing it for fun. And then when I stopped doing it for fun, it was like, it felt like a 9-to-5, like a job you don't want to be at. And that was most, because I wasn't playing the music I wanted to play.
Right.
I wasn't, you know what I mean? I wasn't playing with musicians that I, like, admired. It was just doing it just because. And so when I finally got back.
I've gone through some phases like that, you know. So I completely understand. And, you know, you got to handle with care the things that are precious to you. You know, you got to draw the line somewhere, you know. I always say a music-related job is probably not the best day gig for a musician. You know, it might actually be the worst day job for a musician because that level of frustration is so much higher when you're doing something that to everyone else appears to be music. But you know, it's not music. It's not the music you want to do.
Right.
There's a lot of little peripheral jobs, you know, and even teaching. I mean, you know, teaching is a great profession, but it's not for everybody.
Exactly.
So that can be real frustrating to someone who's basically a player, someone who wants. Yeah, you know, you got to be careful and, you know. Not to contradict Valerie, but I'll say it once again, we have one life to live. You have many lives within that, but you know, you got to be careful about your choices because you might get locked into something in a very frustrating situation for you, you know.
Do you think what she said is like aligns with, I guess, sort of open-air perspective of something, like a change, like something new? Like,
that's how I interpret it.
Right, because when you said that,
and that you're going to go down different paths, you know, and you can't plan all of it. I mean, some people would say you can't plan any of it.
Right.
You could
exactly
plan where you would like to go, but life is going to take you down whatever path. You know, your fate is your fate. You don't know what it's going to be. But yeah, you know, stay open to different things and don't get so wedded to one idea that you lock out some other good possibilities. That's how I interpret what she said.
Right. That's what I was getting at, how I was interpreting it as well. And it's that whole concept of that is so, the reason why I feel like it's so profound is because certain people, I guess, they have limited, so many, I guess I could be specific with musicians, they limit the things they can do, and maybe it's like if they can't, and I think the reason why, I think we talk about this often, like the full-time musician, what does that look like? And a lot of them just see themselves just, okay, I just need to get any gig that pays. And
right.
I feel like that perspective is always gonna, I feel like it's a limited perspective because because there's so many different variations of getting a gig, you know what I mean? And then the process, I feel like they don't really focus on something specific they want to do. And so when it comes down to them, like, booking consistently, they can't because they're just looking for whoever. They don't have a consistency within their schedule to where they're going to be on time and they're going to be potent, all the things that makes a musician get hired. They don't possess those qualities, and so they're just looking for anybody to put them on. And then if they do end up getting a gig that pays well or might put them in the opportunity to get more, they don't, I feel like they're creating stress within that because they're not going to be able to handle it. Or am I looking at it from a different angle to what it is?
Well, everything you said sounds on point to me. You know, I mean, you have a vision of who you are, and sometimes that's limiting, you know. Got to expand the vision of who you are, and you have to know your worth, and you have to know where you want to go with something. I mean, every opportunity is not a good opportunity for each particular person, you know. Something might be great for someone else, and they'll come to me with the same offer, and I'm like, man, I have no desire to do that. I mean, that's completely unappealing to me. Or that doing that particular thing will lock me down for this period of time, and I want that time to something else. Yeah. So, no, I hear you. This what you're saying is really on point.
Yeah, it's just, I get these questions all the time in the emails from aspiring musicians, songwriters, just like variations of creators that make music. You know, and it's sometimes, you know, studio engineers and stuff like that want to, you know, produce and stuff like that. They'll ask me questions on certain things. And I'm like, you got to be, there's a lot of people that have told me, you know, my music mentors told me you have to be a student of the craft first, yeah, in order to understand what it is. And then secondly, knowing the music, like if you're going to be in the music business, you got to understand what it is. And I think a lot of, I've heard somebody say this as well, a veteran musician. They said a lot of musicians don't look at their, what they do or themselves as a business. And that's right, essentially what it is. And it's like, if you're not really contextualizing it like that in terms of wanting to make money, then you're not going to make money. That's how I see it, because it's like, okay, if you're a musician, I'm looking at the bottom line. The bottom line is if you're being for hire, people want somebody that's on time, that know the song, right, and a lot of them don't even have those key components. So it's like, if you're not being a student of craft, if you don't know the music of the artist, or if you're not expanding beyond what's new and what's out now, and you're not going to, I just don't understand. I feel like it's a waste of time. That's what I say. If you're pursuing music and you don't have any kind of business plan in terms of yourself of growing, even with singers, I don't understand putting out singles or songs if you're not planning a tour. You know what I'm saying? Because it's like, at some point, like, you're investing all this money into, if you're putting money into it, because some of them make music in their homes, in the bathroom, or, you know what I mean, try to get the acoustics right to create the record. You're putting all that time in for that record, but what's the business plan with going out on tour? Like, where's the person, the booking agent or your manager, like, where is that at for them to set up? Because essentially, if you're making a song that somebody likes, or if you have fans, they're going to want to see you live in their city. So where's the game plan for that? And I don't see a lot of singers do that. They just put out a lot of records. I mean, on stream it on Apple Music or Spotify or wherever the streaming service is. They just put it out there and don't plan for something else, like to build their audience up. And I don't feel like that's an old school thing.
Yeah, a lot of artists work independently to record their music, and they feel like that's the end of the process. They feel like that's the accomplishment. I've done it. When it's actually the beginning of the process, or it's a catalyst to do something else.
Exactly.
I was talking to the guy. I was talking to this guy that came to the gig last night. He's in the music business. He does some booking for clubs here in New York, and he used to manage some artists. Some names that we know, but I don't want to go into all that. But anyway, we were just talking about how the business has changed, how the business model was not ideal in the past. You know, record companies were taking more than their share of the money you paid from recordings. And, you know, the artists would have to get out there to play to even make some money in many cases. But at least back then, you know, when I grew up, 60s and 70s, we knew what that model was. We knew exactly what the, you know, opportunities were. We knew what the goal was. You know, everybody wanted to get on a label because they had the happening distribution and they had the promotion people who had the money to grease the palms of the radio people. And we all knew the system, you know. It's harder today because there's just so many niche markets. And there's just so many ways to hit it, and there's not this big communal thing anymore, you know. I mean, one time, everybody was listening to the same music, basically, you know, all over the country, all over the world, you know, but definitely all over the country. We all knew the same. We all knew that top 50, that top 100. We're all listening to the same music, you know, across different demographics, across different genres. You had an awareness of who the top country people were, you know, who were the rock people, who were the R&B people. And it was this big communal thing, and we were all connected in that way. And today, I mean, there's more connectivity, but it's almost like it's too much because, you know, everything is fragmented. Like, people put out records and you will never know. Artists put out music and you will never know. You know?
Right.
Somebody will talk about their record. It'll be a record from 10 years ago. It's like, what? I mean, it'll be an artist that you like even. know, it's like, what? You put a record out 10 years ago? How did I miss this? Well, you miss it because there's just so much going on and you can't keep track. And, you know, there's no company, you know, promoting it to the world like it used to be. There are no magazines like there used to be, you know. So, I mean, today's era is good and bad, you know. It's like, well, I won't even say good and bad. I'll just say it's different. It's different. And coming up in the old era, it's just hard for guys like me to make that mental adjustment. You know? There are guys out there who are still thinking about getting that record deal.
Right.
Oh, man, that's old. I mean, that's over. That's over. Why are you even thinking like that? I mean, some of these companies still have a happening distribution thing and have promotion people that can get your stuff on what radio that exists, be it, you know, Sirius XM or whatever. I mean, so there are some advantages to the company thing still. But overall, it's not happening. It's not happening. You got to think a different way. And, you know, it's really hard when you came up in the old thing. We just happened to come up in that time. It reminds me of, like when the Industrial Revolution came in or something, you know. It's like people had to make an adjustment that was, like, from the farming culture to the industrial culture. A lot of people could not cope. And now we're going from the Industrial Revolution to the Digital Revolution. And it's the same thing. I see it. You know, a lot of people can't cope. They can't grasp it. And unfortunately, and, you know, I guess fortunately in some cases, you know, we are living it. We are going through this tectonic shift in music life, you know, in life in general, because the digital thing is affecting every aspect of including what we're doing right now.
right, exactly. Everything is streaming. Internet is pretty much dominant in any force of any kind of career. You know, like even with like food products, like grocery shopping, like you can do all that online now and all that stuff. But I feel like there's always that, like you said, that positive and negative thing to it. But I like, again, it goes back to the perspective, and it's, I feel like what bridges the gap is that understanding of both sides and the music of in terms of music being passed down to different generations of the artists. Cause I see one thing, and I see the youth, the young generation, like the under 18, like I would try to, some people try to broad stroke that generation of being, oh, they don't know anything or that. But let me tell you, it's these young kids that on the internet, they're going viral. Like it says, I follow some of them on Instagram. It's one, his name is Baby Boy Drummer on Instagram. And then there's a young kid, I think he's from Sweden, I think. And he's like so engulfed with Bootsy Collins, James Brown. Like when I tell you this, he's 8 years old, and he has a pocket of somebody that's, like, 52. Like, seriously.
Wow.
And it's, like,
Did you see that, a four-year-old?
Yeah.
Four-year-old drummer?
I told his father, like, I need him to be my life coach because he has the answer. Like, when I saw that video, it was, like, I've been following him for a while, but he was at NAMM. That's, like, I tell people on the show that it's, like, the Grammys for musicians or the Super Bowl for musicians because it's, like, you know what I mean? You know, any facet of life, you see any kind of musician, whether they're 20-year, 5-year learning, you'll see them at NAMM. But
it's like the biggest watering hole ever.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's like the biggest water cooler at the job, you know, worldwide.
It is. That's exactly it. And when I saw the video, I'm like, and that's the thing about musicians. I love seeing that natural chemistry because I know the bassist, his name is Robert Lewis. He's back for many musicians. And if you see him playing, he usually lives in Japan now. So he came back for this, I guess, because he had a product endorsement with a certain brand company, but when he was playing, I could see him seeing LJ having a moment, the four-year-old, and he was like, go ahead. And then once he had that moment, it was just like, I could feel his emotion, and he's like, man, this kid is just having fun and just feeling it. He's not worried about the crowd and what they're interpreting. He's just, like, feeling that moment and just really just having fun. And I was like, I got emotional too, watch, because I'm like, yo, he's just having fun. And I'm like, there's so many things you can take from that, just however many years you've been playing as a musician, of just that. That true essence of, like, just seeing somebody having fun, that youth, and just, and, like, it's so innocent, like, you can't do nothing but feel your heart getting filled up, because it's such a genuine moment. And his skills, like, he's, like, doing his chops, he's doing his thing, and then he goes back to the one. I was like, who does this? Like, who, there's not a adult, I haven't seen none of these older kids. He can outplay any of these older kids now. Like, none of them have that true essence of that pocket. Like, for him to do all that and still come back to that one, I thought was amazing. But, yeah.
He is so like being, good. He is so good. And it feels so good. It feels so good when he plays. Really amazing. Yeah. 4 years old.
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
Right, 4 years old. And it's a testament to his father's teachings. You know, he comes from a musical family. I think one of his aunts, she sings with Quincy Jones. She's done she did a PBS special recently, Quincy Jones. It was an orchestra, and she sung for Quincy. Boy, it was produced by Quincy Jones. Uh-huh. And she sung with him, and that's his.
You know her name?
I forgot her name. I'll send it in a message, because I have her. I follow her on Instagram. She's pretty cool. But I believe his mother is musically gifted as well, but his father plays as well. He's a pianist. Okay. And, you know, and so you can just see that skill being developed by him, and he's such a, and his taste in music is so diverse. Like, one day he's playing Sheila E., and the next he's playing Lenny Kravitz, and then he goes from that to gospel music. It's like well-rounded. You know what I mean? That discipline of as a musician, you see him, like, if he's doing this at 4, I could just imagine what he's going to be doing, like, at 20.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, and that, like, seeing stuff like that gives me hope. Like, okay, the knowledge of the past and the classic music is not going to be thrown away. When I see kids like him and the bass, the 8-year-old kid that's playing Bootsy Collins and D'Angelo, and he's getting the feel of the pocket, and he's just, like, you can see that influence, like, that early. You got, it makes me hopeful of what the next generation, or what these young kids, I wish what these young kids, like LJ and what Aaron, I think that's what his name is, the 8-year-old, like, I wish some of these young ones coming up would body that same energy to what they're doing, because they're getting it right.
Yeah, they're sure getting it right.
Right, but I was going to, we talk about James Ingram a little bit, because that blew me away. Because I heard something about it during Quincy Jones' special they did on BET. They were celebrating his 80th, I think, birthday. It was a special, and Patty Austin had performed Baby Come to Me by herself, and I was wondering then what was going on, and they were saying that he was under the weather at home, and it was making me think, then, like, something was wrong, and that was, like, in December, like, last month when that came out. Or it might have been taped months ago, but I'm just saying when it televised, I was thinking then, and then it was like, man, and it just blew me away, like, 2 days ago when I found out about that. I was like, man, I was like, when you talk about somebody, like, embodying, like, anytime I think of James Ingram, I think of, like, my childhood. Like, it was never not playing. And so it's like, artists like that, you know, you could say specifically, when I heard this song, I felt this way, or I was doing this. It really takes the wind sails out of you a little bit, because it's like, man, it's like, we're getting older, and it's like, the.
Well, I know I always ask you something personal. Do you tell your age? I'll probably ask you that before.
Oh, no, I haven't. I will. I'm 30. I'll be 30.
Oh, young.
I haven't told yet. I don't usually tell it, but yeah. Yeah,
baby.
I'm 30.
You're a baby.
Real young.
You're going to be 31
this year? My knees feel older than I am, though.
You're going to be 31 this year?
No, 30.
Huh?
30. Exactly 30.
You just turned 30?
Yeah, I will be just 30, yeah.
When?
This year.
When? Congrats. What month? When, you don't want to tell your birthday?
In July 31st.
July 31st, you'll be 30. You are a 29-year-old woman. Wow.
Yes.
You're a young sister. But the time goes by quick, so, you know.
Listen, I have the gray hairs and the old ankles and knees to prove it. They've given out on me earlier in my life, so my body is aged great. They'll tell you when you approach a 30 that, you know, you anytime it's cold outside, your knees start hurting. And you got to wear ankle braces to the airport.
I just wanted to get a sense of what your perspective was, you know, vis-a-vis James Ingram. Because, you know, I remember life before James Ingram, before, you know, we knew who he was, you know.
Right.
Where, you know, you kind of grew up on him. I feel connected to him, number one, because he's from Ohio. You know, I'm from Ohio. And we tend to claim each other. And he's from Akron, which is very close to my hometown of Youngstown, you know. Very close. Very close.
Might be related to LeBron James or something.
Yeah. Ohio power. So once I found out he was from Ohio, you know, I had another kind of pride about James Ingram. And when I found out he was a keyboard player, you know, he played keyboards with Ray Charles. He played organ with Ray Charles, you know.
Yeah.
His story just got deeper and deeper, you know, because my first exposure to him was, of course, the Quincy Jones stuff. I guess Just Once was the first one because he had done a demo of Just Once, and Quincy heard it, and he said, well, I need this cat to sing it. You know, this is the voice I want on my album. So that's how that whole thing kicked off. I mean, James was still in the frame of mind of being an instrumentalist because he was like, you sure you don't want me to play? You want me to play? He said, no, I don't want you to play. I want you to sing. And, you know, that... In his mind, I think his whole life somewhere it was like, wow, I am a singer. You know, I don't think he ever really set out for that to be his main thing. But then, you know, that goes back to what we were talking about before, being open to, you know, your fate, what life presents you, you know. Because he could have been stubborn to say, no, I want to play. I'm a player, you know. I play organ. I play keyboard. He could have been that cat. Right. He could have been that guy. And he would have missed out on all this, and we would have missed out on all that beautiful music, all those great performances, you know. How do you keep the music playing? Y'all Gonna Be There, 100 Ways, you know, Secret Garden, on and on.
Yeah, it had the best verse on that song, on Secret Garden, I feel, next to Barry White. Him and Barry White might be tied with that. But I always lean towards James Ingram.
Yeah, bad guy. I saw him in concert. I actually met him before one of his concerts in New York. And you talk about different lives. It was quite a while ago. And his records were, like, still on the radio, you know, the Quincy stuff. And, you know, and I met him. He was cool. He kind of looked at me like, you ever look at somebody, maybe somebody that's kind of famous, and they kind of look at you like suspect a little bit? You know, they're not mean. They're not rude.
Yeah.
But they kind of look at you like, okay, what do you want from me?
Right, yeah.
He looked me right in my eye, and he kind of had that, you know, I kind of felt that vibe, you know. But, you know, he was cool. He shook my hand, pleased to meet you, you know. No small talk. And he went on, and he did a show that blew me away. He was so good. I mean, just so much more than I expected. I mean, his singing was incredible. He played some keyboards. It was incredible. His showmanship was on point. I mean, that stuck with me all these years. It had to be. It might have been 30 years ago. I don't know. Something, you know, it was a long time ago. But
I think I saw him, was in concert 8 years ago. What was it, 20? It was close to 2011. I think I was in New York. He was performing in New York. And, yeah, it was incredible. And then I remember when he did the Lionel Richie tribute. It was televised on VT. I forgot. I think it was the NAACP kind of thing. When they raised money for that, he was performing.
Yeah.
One of Lionel Richie's songs, and I thought it was just amazing. And then I didn't hear from him again. That's when I heard he was sick. Like, he was battling it for years. I think he had cancer. Or allegedly.
Yeah, I heard it was brain cancer.
Yeah.
I heard it was brain cancer. Which I had not heard anything about that, so this was a complete shock to me.
Right. It was just...
I read he was gone. It was like it's just a bolt out of the blue. I didn't know he was ill at all.
Right. It was under wraps. But like I said, when I saw that, when they had said he was ill and couldn't perform at the, because it was Quincy Jones, like, you know what I mean, that whole special, and I was like, they were doing, I thought it was going to be a duet, I thought he was going to come out, but they were like, no, he was under the weather, and then I was like, what's with that?
Yeah, I saw that. I remember that now that you mentioned it.
Yeah, and to me, like, the reason why his voice is significant with me, it was just like, when you get to that point where you're, when I was, like, studying music, when I was still new to it, he was one of the singers that I studied, and then I was seeing, like, old clips of him creating that song with Michael McDonald, and them going over the lead parts. I was just blown away by it, because he's singing lead, because him and Michael are singing lead, but he's doing the background as well. And it was like an old VHS tape kind of recording, so it was a little fuzzy. But it was just watching it, and then his techniques as a singer, and then I could still see that musician side of him come out. I was like, yo, he's really amazing. For him to, like right off the bat, they're just rehearsing it. Like, they wasn't even, this was before they started cutting the track. They were just going over the notes. And the way they were harmonizing, I was like, how is he doing this? Like, he's, like, simultaneously doing two things, doing two things at once. And he's not missing a beat. Like, he's not messing up at all. And I'm like, what kind of skill? Like, nobody, like, that I know of, a singer that, it's only rare few that have that ability to do that. And I was like, that ear.
Well, both of those guys, Michael and James, are musicians, you know, good musicians. So.
Right.
That helps. You know,
right?
They're both great keyboard players as well as singers. You know, I'm not surprised to hear that, really. You know,
but yeah, it was just watching videos like that, because when I like to get in that space of like seeing others create and just watching that video of them and just those like behind the scene moments of just not really caring that the camera's there. You just creating in that moment, like just like documentary footage or something like that. I like seeing stuff like that.
Have you seen the making of We Are the World?
Yes, I've seen it partial. I need to look at the whole thing, but I haven't.
Yeah, this is
I've seen partial.
When James was cutting his part, the other thing about him, he had a great sense of humor. He was very funny, you know. So they went through a take. After a take, he's like, spit flying everywhere.
Yeah, that real side, you see, just that natural in your element, just shooting off. That's like, I love stuff like that. Like,
right, and you know, he wrote PYT for Michael Jackson.
Yes, you know, I know.
I remember seeing him on a Tavis Smiley show, and he talked about that whole thing, how, you know, he wrote it, but then he gave it to Michael, and, you know, Michael would like, dance around in the studio as he was recording.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, James would, like, you know, imitate what Michael was doing.
You know, he was, like, you can hear, and if you pay attention to that song, you can hear Michael trying to do little James Ingram, like, those little nuances that he does with his voice. You can hear him trying to mimic that a little bit, because I'm pretty sure he, like, was listening to the demo or however he recorded it and was, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard that, when he heard the bass line, it was a story behind it. When he heard the bass line, so dang, I had it in my head. I forgot the name of the song, but Michael had heard a song and he did the bass, I think the keys on, and he had heard that song, and that's what made Michael want him on that record, the PYT record.
Oh.
I'm trying to remember what it is. It didn't slip my mind. I had a long day. My mind going blank.
Getting older.
Yes. Absolutely, and it was just, like, the history behind that, and then knowing that he did, you know, a Shalamar song, one of my favorite songs, it was like, whoa, it's like, this guy, like, those are significant songs, like, that bass line in that song is, like, so significant, like, that arrangement in that song, and it's like, you know, he's, like, a key factor to a lot of songs, even behind the scenes, like, that's powerful.
Absolutely. A lot there, you know, but that's how it is with the great ones, you know. There's always a lot below the surface, you know, a lot of things they've done that, you know, we're not even aware they've done, you know, stuff we've been listening to for years, you know, and then you find out, oh, who played on that? That was what, you know. Like, going back to Valerie, she told me she played piano on everything they ever produced.
Oh. No, that's not it.
But that makes me listen to those records differently now that I know that's her playing, you know. Everything.
Right.
She said, no, I played on everything.
Right.
Okay. Heavy.
What do you think of in terms of his legacy, in terms of, because I always felt like he was underrated. In that article that Quincy Jones, I posted this on Instagram, I said that I had a screenshot of the article because I've always had it because I thought it was so profound with Quincy Jones was saying that everybody was so in shock about the controversy of whatever the stories that, you know what I mean, about, you know, saying stuff about Marlon Brando and, you know, Richard Pryor. They were like making big deals about that. The true essence of the article was the gems he was dropping about the musicians and singers that he felt as though should have been bigger than what they were. And then I posted, he said, in the Brothers Johnson, James Ingram, and Tevin Campbell. Like, he's like, are you serious? He's like, they should have been. He's like, they were bigger than life. And I was like, that was what stuck out the most. It was like so many that he dropped, but it was that in particular. I was like, yes, he's 100% right. Like, those were names that, like, when you talk about, like, Louis Johnson, like, on bass, like, created those memorable bass lines from Ball and Thriller. Like, he, like, you know what I mean? And James Ingram and what he contributed, at Tevin Campbell, like, being one of the greatest voices to come out of the 90s, especially male voices that came out of the 90s. It was like, that was so profound. And I was like, I was wishing people would have harping on that more than the whole controversy about with the other scandal stuff or whatever that people were revealing, whatever that was that he revealed. But it was a few people I posted it on Twitter as well when it came out, and a lot of people were feeling it and liked what I said. But I'm like, it should, like, I hate, like, when these moments happen when we lose legends, because it's like, then we remember them. But I always try to, like, that's the reason why I wanted a radio show, so I could play songs, and then if we have segments talking topics or segments of artists or singers or background singers that have contributed to music, I want to, you know, like, I highlight Angela Winbush, I highlight, you know what I mean, Stephanie Mills, like those artists that have contributed in big ways, like James Bentume as a producer. Like, I talk about, like, art, like, stuff, like, people that contribute music in, like, huge ways, and then I try to get them on the show and interview them. Like, we had Chet Crawford on, and they mentioned Babyface. You know, he's incredible art, like, producer all around. But I was like, Chet Crawford has made, like, you know, great songs as well, like, amazing songwriter producers. So I always try to get them on or anyway just talk about, like, the legacy they leave. And
Absolutely.
And what do you feel in terms of, like, legacies like James Ingram? What is it that us as a music lover community, or just anybody in general that loves music, what can we do to keep, you know what I mean, showing that love? Or it should be on a bigger scale of the, like, Grammy shows and, you know what I mean, award shows to show respect more to the artists. How can we contribute to that?
Well, those shows are corporate, you know. They're very bottom line.
Who's
it helps
watch?
If you have somebody. I'm sorry, what?
Oh, they just like, who's going to watch it? That's all they care about is the numbers.
Right.
But yeah.
Right. I mean, that's the main priority. There may be other priorities. It helps if you have somebody on the board of directors or whatever the entity is that loves music, that cares about music. If you have a Quincy Jones on the board or in the, you know, the organizing of it, you know, that helps. Well, you know, what you're doing is good. I always try to just make sure I keep the quality of the music, you know, very high. I don't glom on the trends too much, you know. I keep an eye on what's going on. You know, it's like hip hop, spoken word has been big for so long now. You know, I've incorporated spoken word into my shows. You know, I'm not really a rapper. So I do more like Jill Scott Heron, last poem.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I credit them after I do the poems. I said, okay, that was Gil Scott, you know. That was last poem. Because people always ask, you know, was that yours? Was that yours? Or who is that? Who is that? You know, so that's the way of carrying on the legacy, because, you know, Some of the last poets are gone now, and, you know, Gil is gone. So I'm like, okay, so why should these poems die? Because they have, you know. It's like, so I can carry that on and make people interested. I've had people ask, you know, do they have any records out? I say, yeah, the last poets have quite a few records out, you know. It came out in the 70s mostly. You know? So that's one way of doing it. And I think I was really lucky. I came up in a really great era when all the influences were there from the previous eras, you know, the jazz, the swing era. I studied music, you know. I went to school for music. I wanted to know in a formal way, the way music was organized and what people like Quincy Jones were doing, what people like Arif Martin were doing, you know, and all the jazz people, and bring that into the rhythm and blues stuff that I do, because that's my forte, you know. It's music that has harmony, music that has melody, you know. That's right. What I do. You know, the younger people, they do something different. My son does something different. The rapper, you know, produces tracks. He's got his own method, his own thing. He don't want to hear, well, I won't say that. That's not me. But he always wanted to do things his own way. But as now that he's becoming a young man, he's going to college, he's opening up his mind, so he's getting some more formal education about music. So, but, you know, that those old properties of music and in show business, you know, I try to, you know, how you carry yourself on stage, the way you speak to an audience, how you dress. I got that all from the people that inspired me, because that was exciting to me. See how, you know, the Temptations, the Spinners, to see how Isaac Hayes, Dionne Warwick, Nancy Wilson, see how these people dressed, see how they talked to the audience, you know. That was all, you know, I was in school. I didn't look at it like that at the time, but now I realize I was learning, man. I was in school, and a lot of younger people, they don't know that side of it, how to present stuff to an audience, how to appeal to an audience that doesn't know you or doesn't love you. I mean, when you can play to an audience that doesn't know you and doesn't love you and still entertain them and still play some music that they value, then you've really done something, you know, and there are ways to do that. You can't please everybody.
Right, but, and you're hitting on all the stuff that I was going to get in, like, you be dropping, I call them Facebook gems. I was going to, like, pull up some of your Facebook posts and what you're talking about. One post that I love, I saw, it says, I love James Ingram's work, and he was very successful, accomplished artist, and in some ways underrated. Some people were saying he was the last one, meaning last true male soul R&B singer that he said. You said that part's not true at all. I mean, I understand being sentimental, but in paying James respect, I also give roses to those still here, like people. Al Green, Jeffrey Osborne, Eddie LaVert, Walter Williams, Eddie Holman, Philip Bailey, Russell Tompkins Jr., Lionel Richie, Larry Graham, Gerald Alston, Elle DeBarge, Charlie Wilson, the Scott Twins from The Whispers, and of course, in a class by himself, Stevie Wonder. Then yeah. It says, the wave after that, D. Trey Williams, Johnny Gill, Brian McKnight, Will Downing, Eric Benet, Frank McComb, oh, I gotta get him on the show, he's amazing. Stokely, amazing. And it says, peace and love to the family and friends of the great James Ingram. More power to the soul warriors still doing their thing. And I 100% agree with that. Like, those are all, you literally listed all my favorite male singers. The only one that you didn't name was my favorites are, like, Babyface and Kevon Edmonds, like, from After mm-hmm, 7. Mm-hmm. They still, like, yeah. He's, oh, my, his voice alone, like.
His voice is amazing.
Still mad that he didn't get more than one solo album. Because, man, what were they doing? I was just, you know what I mean? It's just, like, singers like that just.
D'Angelo.
Emotion. Yes, D'Angelo. Like, yes, all my favorites. It's like, those, like, you're 100% right on that. And so, and then you also had some more posts here. You were talking about, and with what you just said about musicians not presenting themselves. Because when I go to shows, like, most of the day, like, you'll see me, like, wearing, because I'm going to the airport majority of the time, and I'm wearing sweatpants and hoodie. But if I'm doing a show, this hair is good. I'm picking this fro out. I'm putting on makeup. I'm putting on lipstick. And I put on outfit, and I struggle through some heels. might have to, if I'm playing the drums, might have to change in the flat. It might be fancy looking flats, but at the end of the day, I'm presenting, you know what I mean, an image to somebody. You know what I mean?
Oh,
it has to be a certain way. And my whole outfit, I'm picking, most of the time I might have to go, like, looking last minute for something, but I'm going to look presentable. I used to do that when I used to play in church all the time. I would go to church looking nice. And I just carried that on stage when I would perform at certain venues. I just looked the part. And then if we're playing something else, it just calls for the occasion. And I get that 100% because I'm not just going to come on anyway. It's like some drummers, I look at them and they're just dressed like any kind of way, like what you're alluding to. And it's like, really? Like, you really think somebody's going to hire you dressed like this? And I actually met a musician. It was a young musician. I'm not going to say his name, but it was a young drummer that was dressed like that, like any kind of way. And
right.
He was supposed to be auditioning for a bassist, and he's been playing for over 20 years. And he's, you know, everywhere. And he was doing a quiet audition, you know, one of those auditions to where they want to get on, that drummer wants to get on to that gig, and they get a shot to do it, but the way he's presented isn't right. He's not in pocket. And so he was hitting off. the bassist is just checking off all the things that he didn't do right. And he asked for, I was there, like, I was in front of him, and he asked for another gig to get on. He's like, well, this is your audition there. He was like, I don't think you passed. And that was it, like, that, it was just like that. It was like a quiet audition, because he thought it was going to be, like, a thing to where he was going to get on just because he knew him. He's like, no. He's like, you're not presented right. He's like,
right. He's
like, why would I get you on to something else important? Like, this is just like an open mic, a musician's playing. So he wasn't even dressed. You know what I mean? He just dressed like he was going, you know, to go take trash out or something.
Right.
So what you're saying was true, because people look at that, whether or not.
Well, for me,
they don't,
you know, for me, there was joy in it. I mean, it was really exciting, of course, to go see, you know, I used to go see a lot of acts when I was young. All people on the radio, all the hit makers, all my favorite people, I would go see them. Usually when they would come to Cleveland, sometimes they would come to Youngstown, but usually I had to drive to Cleveland to see them. And it was exciting to see how they looked. I mean, we were there for the music, but it was exciting to see what they were going to wear, and we would be talking about that after. There was a joy in it. There was another kind of thing that I think a lot of performers, and I won't say just young performers, but a lot of performers today, they don't get that. They don't get that joy. They don't plug into that. They don't have that thing in them. But, you know, for me, that's all part of it, you know. And I'm not telling you what you need to wear, but I'm saying think about what you're wearing. You know, think about
just be conscious
what you're presenting.
Of it.
Like, I got some pushback from this young saxophonist. And he was like, well, I don't want to wear suits, you know. But, yeah, I'm saying I never told you you had to wear suits.
Right.
But he sees me wearing suits.
Yeah.
I'm like, listen, I wear suits because I look good in suits. And the women like it. But you don't have to do that. And I don't do it all the time.
Right, define your style. Right.
Yeah.
But look presentable.
Yeah, but think about what you're presenting, you know, because this is show. This is show business. You know, music can be art. Music can be high art. I'm down with all that. But, you know, it's still show business, man. It's still a show.
Right.
If it wasn't, you could play behind a partition. You know, people could say, it could just be your name on a partition, and you're behind the partition. People don't see you, but they're like, wow, this music is slamming. Yeah, that was satisfying. Now I'm going to go home. No, they come to see you. They come to see you. They come to see what you look like when you're playing the drums. So, what is she, you know, does she hunch her shoulder when she plays, or is she real relaxed, or, you know? People want to see all that, you know. How much do they sweat? I mean, all that, you know. It's all part of it. And if you don't get the joy, I just feel like you're missing out as a performer. I feel like you're missing out. When you just wear what you had on all day, you know, that's like.
Right.
It looks like you don't care. It looks like you don't care. It's not that you don't care, but it looks like you don't care.
Yeah, the whole presentation. You actually, you had a quote, another quote that I want to pull up from your Facebook, you quoted Bobby Hutcherson, and I loved it because I never heard it before. It says, I can adapt to a lot of situations, maybe because of the way I was brought up, listening to a lot. you have to learn how to listen to understand the different nuances that are contained within a certain thing that creates an attitude. That's when you hear a lot of people play music, even though you hear them play a certain style, it doesn't sound right. They might play all the notes, but the attitude isn't there. You got to learn how to listen, and then you have to live that style. It has to come from inside. The people who master how to be subtle have to be ferocious, have to have humility. Those are the great players because they understand these emotions within themselves. It's not just the note. It's the way that note comes about. Then it's the space between the notes. Spaces gives the listener a chance to imagine. And, like, I legitimately, I don't know if it's just a musician thing, but I click with that immediately because it's so many different covers that I listen to. And in terms of, like, certain records, like, it might be somebody doing a Bootsy Collins run off of a Sex Machine, Get On Up. And right. I'm like, this lacking something. And just recently, it was this docuseries I was telling you about. I'm doing Savage Jam. I'm still auditioning guitarists because I'm trying to complete. I have the sound in my head how I want it. And the only completion, I have a three-piece. And the added one in there, I mean a four-piece, but the added one that I need is guitarist. And I have it in my head. And so the songs that I'm having them auditioning, they're lacking in the, it was one, not to put out names, but they were lacking in the emotion because some of those guitar licks had a lot of motion to it. And it's the climax, and most of the songs are like climax to the song. I had them play Funkadelic, Miss Lucifer's Love, and it's like moments to where it's like two-part guitar parts. Even though I only wanted him to play one, but just that one he played, it lacked emotion. I'm like, man, he's not playing, he's not getting the essence of what that song is. And it was another song, it lacked the same thing. I'm like, man, he's not getting the feeling of it. Like, he's playing the notes of it, but it's not no emotion attached. Like, he's not getting the feel in it. And so when I read that, I clicked with it immediately because I'm like, yo, that's what it is. Because it's just certain ways some players, like, it. I remember somebody tweeted, it's like that tick that drummers get in the back of their neck that makes them feel the groove. It's that funk face that the bass players have and the piano player that have that squinch look in their face and they feel it. And the guitarist that throws his head back, it's all those moments that create that energy of the record. And I'm like, that's immediately true, and that's what separates so many people. It's like when I see John Mayer play the guitar, it's like, you know, I see him play live. He's into the song. Like, and Gary Clark Jr., like one of my favorite blues players, guitarists, like singers out right now, he like plays with so much emotion. I love it. It's like, being transported, like, I listen to a lot of B.B. King and Albert King, and he, like, embodies records like that, and he does his own interpretation. And I remember he did Albert King's A Bad Sign, Under a Bad Sign. I forgot the name of it. But he did that record. I remember he did the vamp to that, and I was like, yo, he's, like, into it. Like, his whole body, his own expressiveness. As a musician, like, this is my first time, I think it was, like, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, that was my first time I ever heard of him, and I was like, yo, I need to buy whatever record he has out, because he is amazing. Like, it's the greatest thing I ever heard. And and now he's doing amazing now, because he just, like, captivates audiences, like, in a Jimi Hendrix way, in those legends, but he does it in his own way, because he incorporates different sounds to get what he wants, and it's his own thing. But I love that. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but thank you so much for coming on. You got so many. You drop so many every day. I wish I could go through your whole Facebook. But Will, did you have something to say to Monica before we let him go?
Yes. Well, thank you for giving me 3 minutes, Q-Lan. I really appreciate that.
Listen, okay, we were in the zone. I didn't even look down at my phone while you said
You know, it's just been a little over a whole hour, and that's okay. Marty,
well, I just told you it was going to be me and him talking. So
yeah, I understand.
So I get to ask him my musician question.
Yes, I understand.
I have to worry about nobody.
You know, I used to be a musician. I'm still into music, and you know, I'm the CEO of the radio station. I thought you would give me more than 3 minutes.
I told you we were going to be talking. It was just, listen. Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. Arguing
for later. Hey, Marty. Yeah, listen, you know who started it, because I moved on. Because I could have just ended it right there, but go ahead.
Hey, Marty, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And man, you know, I really appreciate it. I remember your first interview with us, man. It was fantastic. Still need to get you on one of our shows. I'd like to invite you on the Monday Night Madness show one Monday real soon. And we have another music historian that comes on. And he's on every other week, but I like to have you on one week and just have let time with you, man. We go over artists, we go over music, the meaning of music, you know, the
That's
history.
The question you wanted to ask him.
Q-Len. Q-Len. Please.
I'm just saying, we over. I told you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yes, because we work together. This is a radio station. We promote each other, help each other. Right, Q-Len? Thank you. Anyway, Dan, we have a...
Monday thing live.
Yes, it is. One Monday.
Okay.
Yeah, it generally starts at 5 p.m.
We're trying to do the steady gig on Mondays, but, you know, things change. So,
okay.
I'm down to do whatever. If I can carve out the time, I would love to do it.
Okay. All right. Well, we have other shows also. But anyway, the question is centered around, we have another show, Vocal Tips, Danzy Sturdivant, and he mentioned so much about, he's a vocal coach, and he talks about presentation, and something you said struck me. And I was talking about image, right?
Yeah.
And how you look, how you present yourself. And the question is, when you are speaking to the audience, okay, you're talking to the audience like you're one-on-one, right? You're talking to each one of them. Is it in the form of a question or is it in the form of a statement?
Do you mean from the stage or after?
Yes, from the stage. You're engaging the audience. You're getting ready to do your thing. You're getting the audience engaged. Do you, when you're painting your narrative, I mean, are you asking them questions or are you making a statement, maybe a story? Because every, you know, all music has a story, right? So when you engage in that audience, how are you talking to them?
I understand. Everybody has a different technique. You know, my thing is spontaneity. I deal with what's happening at the moment. You know, I have some ideas about what I want to say about the music and when they introduce the guy. I'm very cognizant of the pacing. So don't want too much space between the songs, or if we do have space between the songs, there's got to be something significant stated in that time, you know, give the audience something to take with them. Sometimes I engage the artists, like if I'm playing, for example, we've been talking about the Sugar Bar. You know, that's a smaller place. It's very intimate. You know, people right up on you. You know, sometimes I'll engage them a little bit, you know, just to try to bring them in.
Right.
You know, because some people come to the Sugar Bar. They're there for like a dinner date, and they're not necessarily there for the music per se. So you have to make them aware that this is a show, you know.
Right.
So right from the top, I'm like, welcome to the Sugar Bar. Yeah. I see some other acts, they don't do that. I'm like, that's a mistake. You got to bring people in. You have to address them. Welcome to the Sugar Bar. Let them know this is a thing. Then they see you. Like, they see you in a different light. They say, oh, this is a stage. The lights have come up. You guys are going to play for us. Sometimes I have to tell them, this is a show.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
I just have to be like straight out with it, you know, just so you know. This is not background music. This is a show. This is a music room. And then you're very, you know, polite about it. You always have to be a diplomat, you know. You have to be a psychologist. You have to be a comedian, you know. I always try to make people laugh, you know. And my humor is always spontaneous. I don't have worked out routines. I don't have jokes ready. You know, it's just such spontaneous in the moment. Try to make people laugh. And that's the way I do it, you know.
Right.
But that communication is very important. Some verbal communication is important. You don't have to talk a lot, but what you say has some significance.
Right. Man, that is great. Q-Len, I thought that was wonderful because as a musician yourself, Q-Len, you know, there's a psychological aspect to this as well, and that's why I asked that question. Hey, great, great answer, man. I really appreciate that. Back to you, Q-Len.
Yeah, you have so many great perspective, or I was going to say like so many gems, but your perspective on music, I think just from your standpoint on how many years you've been a musician, and I mean just the experience and the knowledge that you have, I feel like a lot of people could benefit from it. And most of the time I just like take in so much information, but definitely try to take in from somebody older and wiser than me, because even if my 12 years and is, I feel like it's a little bit, but you know what I mean? When I look at, you know what I mean? Cause, you know, it was like, I think that was always my approach to music. It was like, the mentors I had, they were like 30, 40 plus years in. And so when I was intimidated by that, but now it's just like looking at it, it's like a respect I have more than intimidated. It's grown into like a real true respect. I have like musicians that have been doing it for decades.
And well, you know, I try to pass it on. You know, I try to pass on what I've learned. I'm still a student. You know, I never take it from an egotistical perspective. I think some people perceive it that way, and I can't really help that. But, you know, I just want to make the whole thing richer. You know, I just want to make the culture richer. And, you know, and I saw Marvin Gaye. You know, I was there. I saw Stevie Wonder in 1980, you know. I saw the Jackson 5 when they were kids, you know. I was there. I saw James Brown.
Right.
I saw Count Basie. I saw Ella Fitzgerald. I mean, I saw all these people. I was a student of all that, you know. I was feet away from Bobby Hutcherson many nights. Many nights. Anytime he played in New York. Mill Jackson, same thing. You know, Mill Jackson invited me to the studio, you know, when he was recording one of his records. So I've seen all this. It's not just about what I've been through as a player, it's about all the lessons I've gotten from my predecessors, you know. So I'm trying to pass all that on, you know. You know, whoever will receive it, and it'll make the whole thing better. It'll make our whole culture better. It'll bring more people, make more people interested in it, you know. Because people want to know that you're giving them something. You can't have this attitude of like, oh, I'm so good, you need to listen to me. You know, people don't want to hear that.
Right.
You know, people are like, you know, pull me in. Give me something. What is it? You know, what is it? Why do I want to hear you?
Right. You know, Marty, you seem personable. That's what I like about you, man. You seem personal. You know, like a lot of, Q-Lane, you can probably attest to this too. A lot of musicians, it seems like they're like untouchable. Hands all, stay away. You just listen to my music and that's it, right? But you seem like, hey, like, it's somebody cool, somebody you could hang out with, somebody, it might be your brother or somebody like that, you know, or just somebody personal that you can talk to and relate to.
Well, I appreciate that.
No.
You know, I'm real.
Yeah.
I'm real. And I really, that's important to me that I convey that. So I really appreciate you saying that. And I'm going to leave you with this because I got to go eat. I'm starving.
Right. That's what I was about to say. I was about to wrap it up for you.
But I want to leave you with this on the personable tip. I'm going to go back to Valerie Simpson since that's kind of been one of my themes today. In the last long chat I had with her, I told her that it was really... No, I started like this. She said, you know, the Sugar Bar, we've been able to provide this venue for, you know, different talent and... It's been a springboard for a lot of talent. You know, they get put on, you know, just from having this stage and being able to do this, and other people see them, and, you know, they take them, you know, to the stars. And, like, I've seen it happen many times. And then I told her in turn, well, you know, I just really appreciate being accessible. I mean, who does that? Who else on your level has this level of accessibility where you could sit down and talk to the person? Out in touch, then I realized what I just said, reach out and touch. I said, no pun intended. Her response, was, I'm going to leave y'all with
that. Oh, and the song was Carl Carlson's Bad Mamma Jamma. James Ingram did the keyboards on that.
Woo!
That's the one.
I thought that might have been George Duke. That's how cold-blooded that keyboard part is. Oh, my God.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, wow. Every time I hear it, I'm like, man, that sounds like George Duke. That's
James. Yeah, and then a lot of people don't know he did the backgrounds on PYT, too. Him and Howard here did the backgrounds on there. That's why it's just like you get, like, little information from, like years ago, and it's like when you go back and rehear the song, you hear it in there. Like, somebody told me about the Stevie Wonder part-time lover and all the people that did background there, like Betty Wright, Michael Jackson, Luther Vandross. And it's like, yo, I can hear them in there. And it's crazy. But, yeah. Thank you so much for coming on.
Michael's sister's on that record, too.
Yes, absolutely. That's what I was about to say. Ruby Gaye. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, I got to go.
Thank you.
I'll let you go. Thank you so much for coming on.
If you need me, let me know. I'll be glad to come back. I'll be glad to do, you know, the Monday. If I have a free Monday, just let me know.
Okay.
Family now.
I'll inbox you.
Before you go, what's your social media?
Facebook. Oh, okay. Monty Croft on Facebook. That's all I'm working with right now.
Right.
Okay.
Monty Croft. Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Take a quick break.
Oh, it was a loud noise. Did you
hear
that?
I thought he was already gone.
Did you hear that noise?
Yeah. It was
that was the audience.
Oh, I see. It sounds different over the phone. I just want to drop one thing on you before I go eat. These lamb chops.
All right.
We got to look out for, there's going to be a new Brian Blade record sometime this year that we did.
Oh.
The Dynamite record. He was still, last time I talked to him, he's still trying to work out the deal with his last record company, which is Blue Note Records. I don't know if they're going to release it or if he has to take it somewhere else, but the record is Dynamite. We did it in October.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah, I usually don't react to stuff I do like that, but this is really a special record. And also this singer, Kiana Linnell.
Wow.
She won a Sarah Vaughan competition. You know her? So she's got a record coming out. I'm on that as well. So some things to look out for.
You know I'm going to be on your face looking for it.
Right on.
Go check it out. Thank you, Monty.
All right, Q and Will. I'll talk to you later.
All right, sounds great. Okay, Q Land.
We're getting ready for... you already started. We'll be back, y'all.
Compliment. She does send her roses just because you feel violin she loves. Let them play. Dedicate her favorite song and hold her closer. In your arms tonight.
James Ingram. Hey, this is the Soul Sadness Show. What a great interview, Mr. Monte Croft. Q-Lan, he's always a great interview.
Right. I don't even call him interviews. We just be talking.
Yeah. I mean, well, yeah, I know that was the best word I had at the time. But no, well, guess what? He's always a great guest on the show. How about that?
Yeah.
Great guest. I love, and he knows so much about not only, you know, his music, but the history and some of the backgrounds and, you know, some of those gems, like you call them, you know, that we wouldn't ordinarily know. Man, this cat is so, and I meant what I said.
He's a veteran professional musician. That's what you call a working full-time musician. Like, this ain't, like, for the faint of heart, like he was saying about, like, musicianship is, like, one of the toughest, careers you can have. Like, we don't go into it like, oh, like, we gonna do this for a living. Because we got, listen, I'm pretty sure he got stories, and I got stories, like, this ain't for everybody.
No, it's
and
not.
It's a struggle, and you gotta keep reinventing yourself, and that's what artists or veteran musicians like him speak to, how you gotta evolve with the times, and you have to keep evolving in order to grow, and you gotta understand that this is a business. And if you don't understand that concept of that, then you're gonna be lost, and you'll turn into one of those ones, like, that whole stereotype of a starving musician. Cause anybody that sees, any kind of musician, like, they can put it in context of that you're struggling. And not every musician is struggling. Like, it's just, you know what I mean, the decisions you make and how you don't get the perspective of how you present yourself as a musician out into whatever part of the music business you want to be a part of, you're going to be lost. And you're going to be always looking for the next gig, and you're always going to be doing stuff for low pay because you don't understand your work as a business. Because if you don't look at yourself as a business, beyond that, and then also, it's so many levels to it to put yourself in. But I'll say that for my savvy heathen talk after your 6 minutes of rage.
Oh, yeah.
Will's ready.
Yeah, that's good stuff. That is good stuff. The last thing I'm going to say about that and how great I thought the interview was, how humble he is and how he talks about relating to the audience, connecting your audience, you know, playing good, like being arrogant and being, you know, snobbish and stuff like that versus somebody who can connect with the audience and if the audience feel like they're part of what you're doing. I think he brings that.
You have to absolutely do that because then you're going to lose the audience. That's what makes people, right. When you connect with the audience, that's what makes them want to pay money to see you. And if you're not doing that, then that speaks to your professionalism and your ideas of what a performer is. Because if you feel like you just go out there and do a little bit, that's enough. No, you got to engage people. And a lot of people are not engaging because that's a personality thing. And the reason why he has that humbleness about him is because he has a great personality as a musician.
Right.
And a likability quality. If you're not likable, you're not going to get ticket sales or people in the seats to see you. You gotta have a likability factor to you, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're
ready. We're ready to go. And Q-Lan, right. I've got one for you. Oh my God. Oh my God. Jussie Smollett attacked a couple of days ago. If you guys didn't know about that, in the streets of Chicago, it was 2 a.m. Not sure what he was doing. Hey, it's not my business. But anyway, attacked by two white guys spewing racist language. They punched him in his face and poured some type of substance over his head and even tried to lynch him. Well, there was a rope involved. Folks, this is getting out of line. If you don't know who Jussie is, he's that star on Empire, Jamal Lyon. What a shame. Have you noticed an increase in hate crimes these days? Oh, over the last 2 years, how ironic was that? I think 2 years ago we had an election, didn't we? Black girl at McDonald's. Hey guys, did you see this? This came up about a month ago. Now this white guy at McDonald's, he was upset because there were no straws in the lobby. So he's going to approach this black, worker at McDonald's, and she was on her side of the counter and he was on his side. And I guess he didn't like it. She was telling him, well look, by law we can't leave the straws out there anymore. He proceeds to grab her by her collar and pull her towards it. That's when she laid hands on him. Folks, I don't mean this in a biblical fashion. She laid hands on him. Wow. Yep, he got arrested. Good. Barbecue Becky. If you want to know what I'm outraged about, Permit Patty, Cornerstone Caroline, Golf Cart Gale, kids in the swimming pool and getting kicked out because they're black and they live in the complex. Kids selling water. Huh, these people feel that they can call the cops on us anytime they want. Oh my goodness, what is going on here? Oh, did you see this last one? Last week. Oh, this real estate, I don't know if she still has her job or not, but this, real estate salesperson, she claims that these black kids rolled over her foot with a bike. These kids were out there in a peaceful protest last week against gun violence. Okay, on Martin Luther King Day. Well, she came out and she said, oh, they ran over my foot and started yelling, screaming and cussing. Her boyfriend jumps out of the car, Rambo. Oh, he didn't have a scarf around his head with wielding a gun. Are you kidding me? They both should be arrested. Oh, did you notice? Not only that, Portland, Oregon, a black man in the hotel lobby just making a phone call to his mother. Okay, it was a family emergency. And this security guard came up and wanted to see some ID. Well, guess what? They didn't ID anyone else, all right? He was sitting in the lobby making a phone call. They called the cops. Wow. You would think that the manager would do something about this, intervene, and says, oh, no, no, no. He is a guest here. No. The manager followed up on that. The police were called. This man was evicted out of the hotel that he had paid for. Guess what? Didn't even get a refund. Oh, 9 year old, you saw about that. When he, brushed against, what was that, Cornerstone Caroline with his backpack accidentally. She claimed he grabbed her butt. Well, last time I checked, she had no butt to grab. So I don't know what she was talking about, but guess what? She going down like the rest of them. This is unbelievable. Black man tries to get into his apartment and this woman, white woman, follows him all the way in, through the security gates and everything like that, and demanded to know what was he doing there. Who was he there to visit? When he put his key in the door, she said, oh, I just wanted to meet you. Oh my goodness. Are you kidding me? The shutdown. Guess what? For what? And you have these knucklehead senators. I want to know where these guys come from. How do you get to be elected? They make a ton of money for being stupid. Stupid, evil, or maybe a combination of both. How do you get that gig? Man, I need to pay my rent. I got to talk to someone about this. 17 investigations, 20 lawsuits. Kids at the Borussia. Russia. Hey, did you know that they are attacking the Mueller report? Matter of fact, they altered the report. Oh, yes, Russia did. Oh, Trump, nope, they didn't do anything wrong. And guess what? The NRA, I told you guys months ago, the NRA gave Trump $13 million. All right, Trump, Putin gave, or Russia gave the NRA $30 million. And guess what? You remember that black police officer that pro-Trump, the guy, does he have a state trooper head on? I don't know what he does. But anyway, he went over to, Russia. It was an NRA convention. Folks, what's going on? You better pay attention. Get out and vote. Get out and vote. And back to the lead story, Jesse Smollett. I understand that he's doing okay, but that had to be traumatizing. One thing that stands out in this report, folks, I feel to mention that they said, hey, the guys who attacked him says, hey, this is MAGA country. Huh, does it stand out to you? Hey, back to Q-Land. This has been the 6 minutes of rage on the Soul Savages show.
Hey,
back to you, Cleveland.
We are back. Thank you for the 6 minutes of rage, Will. I have to leave very quickly, so my set. I mean, it's been a lot going on today. and this whole bunch going on. And thing is, this is what I'm a musician full time, and this is what I do. And then I create other projects, and it's a frustrating process because it's just a thing when you become a business person. You have to include so many people, and it's annoying when it's just about, to me, like, I'm just fair and consistency and just constant, like, communication. You just have to be on point, and it's just people that ain't texting me back, calling me back, and it's just, it's just builds up. I know how to digress from it, but it's just one of them days to where it was, like, legitimately, if we didn't have Monty on, I would have just, like, canceled today, because it's just one of those days where I just want to be left alone. I don't feel like talking to people, and I just get in those moods. But I don't do that.
You know? No, the show has to go on.
I just wish people would give me that same respect.
Right.
It's just annoying. It's just an annoying process, like, having to communicate with people.
Right.
And it's just in any facet with business and stuff, because I don't bother people unless it's for business reason. It just gets on my nerves that people, I give so much consideration to our guests we have on. And I'm always on that. I treat everybody the same. It's like, you know, I give the same talk, and then it's like, you know what I mean? People cancel on you. There's a lot of people we supposed to have on the show we didn't have on, you know, last year and the year before because scheduling. And I get it. But it's, you know, it's just people that, you know, they just feel like you're supposed to be on their time.
Right.
And it annoys me, especially when I send emails and I've specified in my, like, the way I talk direct, because a lot of people, if you don't talk directly to people in a certain way, they get confused. And then it's confusing to me when you're straightforward and honest and people still don't know how to receive it.
Right.
And I'm just learning. Just who is wasting my time and who's not wasting my time. That's pretty much the space I'm in right now.
Right.
And the people that's wasting my time, I'm about, like, halfway through it. And you try to be considerate. But it's like, how much consideration should I give to the point to where I just completely just X them out? Because it's annoying. And I'm just being transparent right now because a lot of y'all don't.
Right. Hey, Q-Lan, like, let me say this real quick. Let me say this real quick. You know, since we started the station about, radio station about, actually 4 years ago, thank God, January 1st was our anniversary. Well, New Year's Eve going into, New Year's Eve 2014, January, 2015. Since then, Q-Lan, I can promise you, approximately about 20 to 25 people have come and gone through the station for the very same reasons that you're talking about. But you know, the show goes on if your heart and soul is into it. And then those same people, once we hit our mark, and we will, Q-Lan, we will hit our mark, they're going, oh God, how can I get back on? Okay. Well, sometimes those ships have sailed, but you know, when you first started this Soul Savage show, it was just you. And then you had me on before you fired me. You had me on as your co-host. But you know what? You are there. You're always consistent and you're always there. And guess what? You can, it's hard to break a diamond, and you're a diamond, Q-Lan.
Man, I appreciate that. Cause it's just, it gets frustrating. Cause it's
don't,
like,
worry about it.
Man, it's like people understand, like, when you're a business, when you're your own business, like, I only have few people to help me. Most of it, I'm doing myself. And so you asking me to do it literally like 15 things at one time, and I'm doing it every week.
Right.
Like, I book the people on the show. Like, we don't have, like, assistants and stuff like that that book. I personally book them on because I want to talk to them about whatever it is they're promoting at the time, whatever they contributed to music, or if they're not in entertainment, if they're just, you know, doing stuff outside of the entertainment realm, I'm still interested in it. So I want to interview them, and I book them on. I book the guests on. And I've said we've been pretty consistent with booking people on. And getting back to people on time with emails and stuff like that. And it's like, I have to do all that myself. And so, and I don't ask anybody else to do it because I don't want to burden them with it. But it's like, damn, it's like, how much do I have to do? You know what I mean? It's just annoying. It's like, I'm annoyed by everybody. And okay. It's just to that point to where when it becomes a, like a trend of the week or where somebody, I'm supposed to contact somebody and they don't hit me. Like, it's not like I'm like BSing around. Like, this is serious stuff.
Right.
And it's like, nah, like I'm good. Like, right. I'd rather people just say that than just to act like they care.
Right, 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 right.
That's what pisses me off, I think, because it's like you're acting like you care when you don't.
Right.
It's just like, and that's where I'm at right now with the musicians, singers, people I'm working with these projects. It's just the docuseries. I'm just getting to that point because it's like, and you know what it is? It's a change of atmosphere. That's another thing. And that's why when I said, y'all, I think it was last December or last month when I said I'm moving, that's a like key component to why I'm moving. Because it's like, whether if I'm on the East Coast or the Midwest, like, it's just something about L.A., the where it's people that striving to get stuff done. I'm telling you, I went one weekend in L.A. last year, and I got way more accomplished that weekend than I ever did, like, these past, like, 4 years I've been going back and forth and down.
Right.
Like, seriously. Like, you mean, like, stuff that would take, like, 2 to 3 years for me to accomplish, I got done in a weekend.
I understand.
And just like changing the atmosphere is another key component of it, but that's like a year off. And so I have goals that I'm accomplishing like in the now, but futuristically in the next year or two, that's where I'm headed is California. But going, getting prepared there is making me mad. And it's like, I just want to rush the process. With like that. You got to be patient and wait it out, but I'm ready to move. Like,
right.
Because it's like, the ideas I have, the things I want to get accomplished, I have to do there.
Right. Well, let me.
That I want involved here, that I want to take with me, are inconsistent. And it's like, the only way I'm going to get this done is just revamping everything, getting a whole new crew. It may be 2 or 3 people I'm bringing with me, but the rest of them, I'm X-ing out. Like, seriously, because it's just like, I want to work with people that want to be worked with.
I want to
split money with people that want to split money with. Like, I don't want to hear, like, you're supposed to show up at 4 o'clock. Here it is, 6 o'clock, you show up, and you're costing me money in video production. Like, I'm tired of that. Like, it's annoying. Like, I'm literally paying you to be here, but I can't pay you because you're not on time. Now I got to dock your pay.
Right.
It's stuff like that.
Right.
And there's other stuff going on with the show. I'm not going to put it on air.
No, we're not going to do that.
That's pissing me off. Yeah, I'm not going to do that. But it's pissing me off as well. And so here it is. I'm dealing with multiple things, and I'm trying to contextualize it to not, like, flip out on anybody. So I'm not contacting anybody to misinterpret whatever it is. But at the end of the day, there's no communication happening, and it's pissing me off.
Right.
Like, everybody's pissing me off.
Oh.
And so,
well, your engineer, correct that, your engineer is right here.
Yeah. Like people, like, that's why my energy is always correct coming at you, and I don't put it out on you, even when we talk before the show. I just let you know what's happening.
Right.
And then we move on with
the show. We're just going with the show.
I'm not going to, like, put my negative or whatever it is I'm feeling. I'm not going to put that on you. Because it could have turned either way. Like, people wouldn't even, like, there's people probably listening now, like, wow, I didn't even know you were...
Right, upset about anything.
Like, this is, like, last year's stuff, like, that I'm dealing with. Like, many a times to where, like, I came on here feeling a way, and then I just tuck it in the back and move on, because I'm a musician, and I'm used to a show going on.
Right. You got to have it on.
You're a businessman, so you're used to that. People that deal with business are used to it, but people that ain't used to owning
it. You don't like it. You
and
don't like
they
it.
Don't, they got to internalize everything.
You
and
have
like,
to. Right.
It's like they act like they're the only person going. I'm like, dude, you know we run this ourselves. Like, you act like not to diss anybody that does 9-to-5 jobs, but like you have a guarantee check, a safety net. I don't have a safety net.
Yeah, right.
And so, of course, there's intensity about it. And that's where some people accuse me of being intense. And too, I'm like, and too passionate. I'm like, this is my livelihood.
This is,
like,
yeah.
This is, like, something
really?
I created.
That's
so,
right.
Of course, I'm going to be passionate about it.
That's
like,
right.
Why would I give that energy to somebody that I work for instead of myself?
Absolutely.
That's the tricky thing about it.
Yeah, you ask people who have...
People that energy to somebody they work with instead of on themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
And those people want to work with me.
Right.
And I'm like, Like, how are you going to have that energy? You got to, it's just a team player thing, man. I guess my savvy heat talk is, like, team player, we got to figure out some way to hone the skills of that and being consistent and creating work ethics. Because it's like, and then it just, I know.
And Q-Lan, lastly, before we play your last song here, I want to say this. It might be a blessing in disguise. Some of these people, it could be their failure to do what they're supposed to do is just making room for you to find the people that we need.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm thinking.
Let's do that.
I don't want nobody to feel no kind of way and think I'm like pinpointing somebody in particular. I'm talking about multiple situations. I had multiple business dealings with people, and a lot of it is stuff that I'm trying to create that hasn't been created yet. So I don't want nobody to think I'm calling anybody, specifically anybody else on this show that co-hosts here. I'm not talking about any of that. It's separate, whole separate situations going on. What I'm just saying is that it's just getting to one of those days to where too much is going on, and I'm trying to reject it. And the crazy thing is because when I started getting these new deals that came upon, like, that's where it started from. It's always when more money comes in, that's when more problems happen. It's always the case for me. Like, that's why I don't get comfortable and think that, oh, I made this much. Like, no, because I know it's not going to be mine for, like, you know what I mean? For a minute.
Oh, so tell me about it. Tell me about it.
Like, I have to keep creating some kind of revenue from it. I mean, even though it's a nice chunk of change, but it's like, at some point, it's going to go out. And it's like, I got to keep thinking ahead. I got to keep creating stuff.
Yeah.
But that, once again, that teamwork stuff, man, it's annoying. It's like, that's why I hate doing group projects when I was in high school and college. Like, I hated it. Because you would always end up being, I always ended up being the one person doing all the work. And that's, it's annoying. Because people be with you. And then when it comes the day you're supposed to turn it in, oh, I had a doctor's appointment. Oh, my kid had a doctor's appointment. Like, really?
Excuses.
Like, stuff like that. It's like, you know you got a deadline, but they rather do something else beyond what they were supposed to do. And I always, it's just like that. I say life is like a group project. That's my fat heathen talk. So we go in early.
All right.
I know we've ended pretty early. But yeah, rest on the James Inger, one of my favorite
movies. Man, yes.
Such a just a complete nostalgia feeling when I hear him. Thinking back to childhood, like, his songs were always being played in my household. But yeah, rest on the James Ingram, such an incomparable singer, one of the best, one of the strongest voices to come out of the late 70s, 80s. But yeah, thank y'all for tuning in every Thursday, 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And yeah, hopefully, we have co-hosts back next week.
Oh, we want to have a great show.
Oh, well, Whitney has other business to attend to.
Right.
I don't know what's going on with that, but we'll be back every Thursday, 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Studio W Buzz. Check it out on your IMV2 app or StudioWBuzz.com.
That's it. And, let's get it.
Hit you with one of my favorite tunes, Baby Come to Me, and we out.
Thinking back in time when love was only in my mind, I realized ain't no second chance. You got to hold on to romance, don't let it slide. There's a special kind of magic in the air when you find another heart that needs.
Baby, come to me. Let me put my arms around you. This was meant to be. And I'm also glad I found you. Need you every day. Gotta have your love around me, baby. Always stay. Cause I can't go back to living without you.
Spending every time to keep you talking on the line. That's how it was. And all those walks together out in any kind of weather just because.